Hello, I'm delighted to say that this episode of Film Stories is sponsored by NordVPN. Now, if you're unfamiliar with a VPN, it is a virtual private network, and it's a service that basically allows you to pretend that your computer or device is in a different country. So you set a virtual location for your device, and that means that suddenly you can get access to things that otherwise you might not be able to see. So for instance, if you're a Netflix subscriber, you set your NordVPN to America, then you get a plethora of options from American Netflix rather than UK Netflix, which is where this podcast is based. You can do this with all sorts of things. You switch the virtual location of your VPN service, and then you get access to TV shows, to films, to sporting events, streaming services and such like that you just wouldn't be able to get from the UK. A quick mention too for the cybersecurity features of NordVPN, including shielding your online activities, encrypting your connection, and using threat protection as well. To take advantage of this, you need to go to nordvpn.com/filmstories. That's nordvpn.com/filmstories. And you can try it risk-free with a 30-day money-back guarantee to get the best discount off your NordVPN plan. If you go to that Film Stories link, that will give you an extra 4 months free on top of the 2-year plan. And again, there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. And you will also find the link in the podcast episode description box. Hello, this is Simon Brew. I'm the editor of Film Stories magazine, and a very warm welcome to a very special episode of the Film Stories podcast.
Come with me.
And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
And movies that had stories.
That the story just sucks them in.
This is just the beginning.
Film Stories. We would be honored if you would join us.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to Film Stories with Simon Brew. I am Simon Brew. As always, there's absolutely everything you need to know about me. The aim of the podcast, though, well, it's given away in the title. I'm here to talk of the stories of films. And I tend to talk about development stories, marketing stories, release stories, production stories, all the ingredients, really, that go towards making the films that we know and sometimes love. Just that, the films that we know and sometimes love. The films I tend to cover on this podcast lean more towards the mainstream than anything else. They're films I'm interested in or invested in to some degree. I try really hard not to do snark. I try really hard not to punch down. This podcast is a celebration of cinema and a real appreciation that somehow, films exist. What you've happened upon here is one of my occasional special episodes of Film Stories, though. And this is where I bring in a filmmaker to talk about their latest release and stroke or their body of work. In this case, you're getting a bit of both, really, because I'm delighted that someone I've been chasing for a long time for this podcast, director Philip Noyce, is joining me for this Film Stories podcast special. So we recorded it over Zoom a few days just before this is going out on release. So that accounts for one or two little foibles and just slight delays in the audio. The conversation, first and foremost, is to talk about his latest film, a film called Fast Charlie, starring Pierce Brosnan, a really delightful, actually, 90-minute movie, which has been released in the UK just as this podcast is going out onto general release as well. I do get in quite a lot of questions about his other films as well. So we're going to talk, for instance, briefly about Newsfront, which he made in the 1970s in Australia and was a real breakthrough movie for him. Then when we talk about moving to America, well, Rutger Hauer in Blind Fury comes up, and in particular, Dan Grobnik, the producer of Blind Fury, who also produces Fast Charlie, that's discussed. We're going to touch on the thriller Dead Calm. We're going to look a little bit at The Quiet American, at the film Rabbit Proof Fence as well. I think you get a tiny bit of sliver in there. You certainly get some Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. And then I just name check a thriller called Above Suspicion that Philip Noyce made in 2021 after being away from filmmaking following the release of The Giver, which we also talk about a little bit towards the end of this particular episode. I think, though, that is about as much setup as you need. Save to explain, there's one bit where he starts talking about if he can't get a film made, he'll use this. Now, what you can't see is he's waving around a mobile phone, quite a powerful looking one, as it turns out. And so he's basically talking at that stage about he'll just carry on making films on his phone. So that's possibly the only other bit of explanation you need. What I'm going to do now is play you a clip from the trailer from Fast Charlie. You'll hear the other side of this, my conversation with Philip Noyce.
I'm not an enforcer. I'm
I'm more like
a fixer.
Exactly. I have to convince a certain person that the body in that trunk out there is indeed Rolo.
Something happened to his face?
What the? It's missing, along with the rest of his head. Betrayal's a funny thing. Its very nature is to catch you unaware.
You ever heard a Ring doorbell?
We're under attack. Go tell that mountain
liar. Stan's gone. And you should be too.
I've always had one rule, Sal. Be good to the people who were good to you.
Be good to yourself, Charlie. And get as far away from here as you can.
Turned on your own.
You ought to get out of Biloxi, Charlie.
That's what everyone keeps telling me.
That was a clip from Fast Charlie. I am delighted to be joined by its director, Philip Noyce, who also happens to be the director of the tensest printer scene in all of cinema history. Hello, Philip Noyce. How are you?
Hello. I'm curious to find out what that scene is.
It's in Clear and Present Danger. It's when Harrison Ford is trying to stall Henry Czerny. And I talk to people about that scene an awful lot as just a masterclass in editing and tension in the middle of what, you know, ostensibly was a big summer movie. I mean, tell me stories of that scene, because I mean, loads of us talk about it, loads.
Well, that was the first day of filming on Clear and Present Danger. Steve Zalian had written that particular scene. He was one of three Academy Award-winning writers who worked on the movie. He wrote that scene, and he was there throughout the day making changes to who said what to whom and so on, particularly when Harrison stormed out and met Henry Czerny in the in between space between their two offices. What else can I say? The music by James Horner was very important.
Yeah,
the scene didn't come together really truly until James's score had been written and recorded, because he's such a good storyteller, or was. Yeah. Because he passed away in a tragic accident. And I was pleased that the New York Times reviewer commented on that particular scene, because I was proud of the way we shot it and edited it.
Loved it. Loved it. On James Horner, I've been listening to the score of Phil Alden Robertson's Sneakers today, and it's exactly the same. The elevate, what his music adds to certain bits of tension in that is incredible. Oh, thank you for talking about that. I really love that moment. I've been reading a book about you today as well, which I think you wrote with Ingo Petzk, is it?
Ingo Petzk, a German film professor.
Yeah.
Came to Australia. He couldn't quite see it because of your focus.
Okay, that's a picture of you on the front cover of the book.
Bring it back towards you, right beside your face. No. Oh, there. Okay, there we are. That's a shot taken by an assistant director on the set of The Saint shooting. Anyway, the book was written by this German film professor. It wasn't written by him, it's sort of written by both of us, in as much as he came to stay with me here in Los Angeles for a few months. And every day he would come downstairs and record another interview. And then he edited the interviews into a book.
My copy of the book didn't come with the CD-ROM, which apparently you put loads of storyboards and background material in there as well.
Storyboards and all sorts of things. There's also a copy in Vietnamese. The Vietnamese took the book and translated it. Yeah. So it came out in Vietnam. My wife and I and two children went on a 3-week book tour of Vietnam promoting the book.
That's amazing. I mean, one of my favorite things in the book is you showing your daughter your films first.
And I think there's a moment where you showed a sliver and she told you to sort your next film out before you showed anyone else that. And then you showed Clear and Present Danger to her and she said, no, you can show people that one and you'll still get another job afterwards. Do you still keep that process going?
Well, to a degree, she's now in her 40s. She was a teenager when we started that. Well, actually, she was even younger. Because when we were making Patriot Games, she was the one who revealed to me the spy satellite capability of the American government. You want to hear that story?
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So I thought I was, you know, really smart. I got Harrison Ford to come with me to explore the ins and outs of all the secrets of the American intelligence agencies, and I thought that I was getting all the doors open because I was with Harrison, but I also had the 11-year-old daughter with me, and when we went to the Navy Yard, where they've got a lot of secrets in Washington, she wasn't able to come into the secret part, so she went off with a naval officer who babysat her. Now, afterwards, I'm telling her what I saw, which was all these secrets and weapons and stuff. And I said, what did you do? She said, I was looking at these stick figures, heat images in Cuba. I said, I beg your pardon, you were doing what? She said, well, you know, I went into this place and there they were. They were looking at this Cuban military base. And I said, well, what did you see? She said, well, not much. It was just like heat signatures. And I said, what? This is back in the early 90s. And I got her to describe it. Then I contacted the people that who sent me on the tour. They said, we don't know what you're talking about. Anyway, I trusted her. We invented the sequence where Harrison is watching as this this alleged terrorist base is destroying. We filmed it all. And of course, while we were waiting for the film to come out, there was the attack on Iraq, and we saw all of this technology on display, and it became, you know, well known. But it was my 11-year-old daughter who set that whole scene up. And she's the daughter who now I sent in the 40s. She's a lawyer, a human rights lawyer in Sydney, Australia. Yeah. And I sent her Fast Charlie. And I thought, oh, she's going to like this, you know, it's too much fun, too ribald, whatever. And she gave it a thumbs up. So that was a huge relief.
I mean, one of the other things throughout the book is your co-author in there talks about when you get a good review off Variety, because it just happens so rarely by the looks of it. There's almost a surprise when you get a nice review.
Once again, you know, Owen Gleiberman, I think that's his name, Variety reviewer. I opened it up, my Variety online, and saw, oh, my God, he's reviewed Fast Charlie. And it was a rave. You never know.
Was it always your daughter's review that was the key one for you?
It is because she's a truth sayer, and she's got no reason to bull dust me. She usually lets it fly on all sorts of subjects.
I love the fact that we got a scene in a movie because an 11-year-old went off on a slightly different bit of the tour than everyone else. That's incredible. I mean, Fast Charlie just felt to me. I had so much fun with Fast Charlie. It just feels like kind of the pulpy thriller that's gone out of vogue a little bit. And I always think it's telling now when the list of executive producers is longer than the cast.
But there's a reason for that.
Yeah, of course.
A very practical reason. This film, 5 days before shooting, the producers announced that there was no money. In the kitty. It was a Thursday, Friday payday. So the crew were faced with not being paid the next day and also the film not starting on the Monday. So then the word went out, we need money. Well, you've got 26 executive producer credits at the beginning of the movie. Each one of them saved us by investing in sometimes an hour of shooting, sometimes a day, sometimes a week. But we kept shooting. We had some hairy Fridays where the money was sort of not quite there. We promise it'll be there by the end of the day. One day, I'll tell you, Pierce is doing this wonderful scene where he's talking a monologue, you know, where he just talks about his father and the relationship with Jimmy Khan's character. He's telling Marina Baccarin. Yeah. His big dramatic scene in the movie. Crew went out on strike 5 times because they hadn't been paid, you know. So I'm not telling Pierce that this is happening, you know. So I just pretended that I needed a little bit more rehearsal. The camera wasn't quite right. The lights weren't right. And eventually, the last part of the crew to go out were the lighting team. And I said to my Australian cinematographer, Warwick Thornton, I said, can you go out and see if you can get them to come back to work? We've got to finish this close-up on Pierce. Anyway, he went outside and I looked through the window and he gave his thumbs up and I said, and we're rolling. And the lights came on and we shot Pierce's close-up. Later, I told Pierce about all this and he was just said he was oblivious to all of the backstage drama that had happened during that day. Anyway,
a little bit.
That's independent filmmaking, you know.
Oh, of course.
On a typewriter.
Of course. And I talk to a lot of independent filmmakers and they give me the rule of thumb. The more executive producers, the more different pots of money you've had to tap into. I mean, that way of shooting, I mean, does it almost go a little bit full circle back to Newsfront for you? Because I remember reading ages ago on that you didn't, when you approach making Newsfront, you didn't have the money to shoot all of the scripted scenes. And you needed to be quite nimble about it.
Yeah, to a degree, except the money didn't run out. I mean, we just didn't have quite as much as we needed, so we had to cut down the script to fit the budget. But that's what you do always. There's never enough money, and there's no use complaining about it because there's never enough. You always have bigger ideas than your production manager or your producer can afford. No, that was different than this. This was a situation where the money just didn't turn up on a Friday or was late. So we'd have to sort of shuffle around and make excuses and try and keep everyone working, which they did do. Not to complain about the crew. We had the most marvelous crew in New Orleans shooting this film. And in some ways, you know, the problems made for a better movie. For example, we had to cut so much out of the budget that it went from being a straightforward action film with the A on action, a big capital A of action, into a film that's as much about the characters as it is about the set piece action pieces. So, you know, I think we made a better film as a result of having to cut our cloth to fit, in truth. We also had to cut 20 pages out of the script. So, you know, that's why it's a 90-minute film.
Now, I'm just grateful for 90-minute films at my age. I think 90-minute films are an absolute blessing, and more of them, please.
Well, when we made it a 90-minute film, I thought, oh, people are going to complain about this. It's too short. Okay, so that reviewer we were talking about from Variety, Owen Blumman, he said 90 minutes is just the perfect length for this movie. This guy's to be congratulated for telling a story so succinctly. So sometimes, you know, necessity is the mother of good invention.
I mean, I really like Killers of the Flower Moon, don't get me wrong, but my bladder and it did have a bit of an argument. That 90 minutes, absolutely bang on.
That's a medical issue, I think.
You can understand that. There's a whole backstory I won't go into there, don't worry.
I will give you some advice later when we're offline.
My understanding on Fast Charlie as well is there was a version of it that nearly came to life before and that there was a pre-existing script. At one stage many years ago, a director nearly came close to doing it. When you, I mean, this must happen to you before throughout your career. Do you have a kind of process for it, or do you just come to these things completely cold?
Kevin Costner, by the way, owned the rights to
Is that why he's in the thanks?
Is he in the thanks?
You've got him and Bryan Cranston in the special thanks at the end.
Oh, well, yes. Bryan Cranston at one stage was thinking about being in the movie.
Yeah.
But that didn't turn out. And Kevin Costner at one stage wanted to make the movie, direct it, and play Charlie himself.
Yeah.
So that's the reason. But I don't remember the Costner one. Someone must have snuck it in. But I wasn't aware of that when I read the first script. I wasn't aware of any of that. You know, films can have a long, long life.
Of course.
When I got hold of the script of Quiet American, Sidney Pollack had already spent 9 years with various screenwriters working on it, and I spent another 7. So, you know.
There's no use
thinking about who touched this movie before, you know.
It's
inappropriate.
Can I talk just briefly about Dan Grobnik then? Because I found his name right near the start of your Hollywood career with Blind Fury, and I'd imagine that's the link between this, but I just wanted to ask you that.
It is. Way back, beginning of my Hollywood career, I'd shot Dead Calm. It hadn't come out. And I got offered this film, a low-budget film of Rutger Hauer, by Dan Grobnik, producer of Fast Charlie. While we were editing Dead Calm, I came across to America, shot Blind Fury. And then all these years later, you know, the phone rings, well, not rings, buzzes or whatever the noise it makes nowadays, and it's Dan Grobnik. Hadn't heard from him since, didn't know what he'd done or anything. Probably should have checked. But I read the novel and then got caught up in it all. And here it is, Fast Charlie, the movie.
I read when you were making Above Suspicion about almost the joy of going back totally independent, about taking some of the voices out of the room and, I mean, just being able to make the film that you wanted. Did you have a similar experience here? I mean, was there...
I did, except for the banishing funds that, you know...
Yes, I can imagine that was a problem.
But how to solve those problems was entirely my invention and doing, yes. But I will say this. Even the studio system, it actually does give you, or did for me when I was working, a lot of freedom. Where it becomes a problem with the studio in the studio system is when you test a movie.
Yes.
You test a movie and there's a magic number. It's sort of 75. Below 75 out of 100 from the audience, and, you know, you're in trouble. And the lower it gets, the more trouble you're in. Above 75, well, that's good enough for you to sort of finish the movie the way you want. In the 80s, they back up trucks full of money and say, just finish it quickly. 90s, oh, my God, you're in heaven. So I've had films, Clear and Present Danger, 94 at its first screening. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
That was direct to heaven. What do you need? What do you want? We'll do it for you. Quiet American at its first test screening was somewhere in the 20s. You know, that took months to clear that debt and get it back up there where it needed to be. So the studio system does give you a lot of freedom. Oh, there's my Ring doorbell. It must be guys trying to assassinate me.
I was reading, again, going back to the book, I was reading your top three test scores were for Clear, that's why I'm just looking over here, were Clear and Present Danger, The Bone Collector, and Blind Fury. Is that, I mean, is that right? That's a triple bill, that is.
It was Blind Fury, but Blind Fury in Queensland, Australia.
Yes.
He took it to Queensland, Australia to prove to TriStar, Columbia, Sony, as they're called now, that it was a viable movie.
So Fast Charlie, I mean, how much of that apparatus were you happy to be without? I mean, could you do a test screening on it? Was it a little bit more nimble again? Was it a lot more gut?
We did a test screening. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, truthfully, you need test screenings. We depend on it's no use getting your friends and family to come and watch your movie. They're the worst people.
Unless it's your daughter.
Unless it's your daughter, yes.
Yeah.
Sure. But, you know, generally, your friends won't tell you, they'll tell you anything but the truth. So when they say it's great, you've got to question them, you know. So it's no use. It's only the person you don't know who has no interest in you, your career, your movie. They're the people you want to get a reaction from, because they guide you through the way the movie's playing for an audience. And they also inevitably bring up inconsistencies or plot points that you think are so obvious that you just didn't realize that there was a problem in that scene or this scene, you know, that they couldn't understand something that you thought, having lived with it for months, for years, you know, was so obvious.
You talk back there about how 80s they backed up a truckload of money and 90s was heaven. And I mean, you've talked about your Hollywood period in the 90s, and you've talked more recently as well about being able to keep working and what a blessing that is. I do wonder, though, I've never asked this of a director before. Did you feel you worked too hard? I mean, I hadn't seen the story in the book, for instance, about having to get vitamin shots on the set of Sliver. You know, so close together these films were coming or anything like that.
No. You would.
This is why I ask. This is why I ask.
Coming from Australia, where you Brits and the Yanks controlled everything. You controlled the movie making. You controlled the theatres that the movies were shown in. And you locked us Aussies out of a film industry. I grew up not being able to hear the Australian accent in a movie theater. And so everything that happened to me has been a gift. Being a film director wasn't a job. There was no such job in Australia. So, you know, I don't take anything for granted. It's all a gift. And I'll tell you what, for a director, there's no longest day or working too much. It's just... you know, it's just fabulous to be able to spend tens of millions of dollars on telling stories. You know, and I'll tell you what, I got this one ready. If they take away my license, if they take away the money, here's where it is. Write scripts, film them, edit them, monetize them on YouTube, like the Raka Raka brothers, you know, the two Aussie brothers who made to me. I mean, there it is. It can all be done on a phone. That's your movie studio 2024.
I tell my kids the story about their mobile phones got trillions more computer power than the moon landing computers, and they look at me as if I've gone completely mad.
Makes you wonder why we're having so much trouble getting back up to the moon, doesn't it? Really,
it really does. Well, there's too much money in it now, isn't there? I'm conscious as well. I mean, you holding a phone up there and just kind of the independent spirit. But also you were talking about Australians. Two things in particular I wanted to ask you about Australia. Number one was just the sheer chutzpah, really. Of you hired a cinema for 700 people to put on screenings of your graduation films, I've been reading.
Not 700. I think there were 600. It wasn't that I wasn't putting on a screening. I was charging them
$2.50.
Yeah, $2.50, which was unheard of. At the time, I was married to Jan Chapman, producer of The Piano and other movies.
Right.
She was collecting the money, And when it got up around her waist and I looked into the ticket booth, I said to myself, my goodness, this is a good business to be in if you own the movie, if you own the movie. So I didn't hire a cinema for 700 in order to let people see my movie. It was to charge them money.
I also wanted to ask.
Learn the basic lesson of movie making. Control the movie. Own it. Don't let it go.
I'm assuming that that's something that's kind of been ingrained in you pretty much ever since by the look in your eyes.
It has been, but you know what? To get the money,
yeah,
sometimes you've got to sign your way, you know, your ownership. Rabbit Proof Fence, a film that I love making and love selling around the world, that's been the most successful movie as a percentage of cost for me.
Yeah.
Because we own it. The 19 people who made the movie, principal makers, each own a piece of that film. And we still get a lot of money every year back for those 19 stakeholders.
And it's the film you're proudest of as well, I should note, yeah?
It is because I hope it was entertaining, but I also hope it was educational, that it was illuminating to audiences all around the world. I think it was. And I think it changed hearts and minds in Australia too, when the Australian government made an official apology to the stolen generation of Indigenous Australians.
Yeah.
It was also because everyone said, film about three Indigenous children, no one's going to pay for that movie. And if they do, no one's going to go and see the movie. So those were fighting words to me. And I was determined to find the money. I would have shot the film on my handycam. I actually did start to do that. And then we raised money. It was just such a thrill to be able to prove all the naysayers wrong and to make a film that sold all around the world and has been very profitable.
So a couple of minutes ago, you blamed Britain for...
That's an Aussie affliction.
I understand it completely. Don't worry, I get the other side of it.
But you know, we're very proud of the fact that you sent a lot of criminals down to Australia because the people that you guys thought were criminals were actually the best Aussie breeding stock you could ever imagine. I mean, we got the Tol Pavel Marvis got sent down there, started the union movement. We got Irish revolutionaries. We got Scottish missionaries who are fighting the Church of England. We got all sorts of riffraff from the British Isles, and that's the Aussie spirit. Thank you.
You should see the bit of Britain I come from. You wouldn't. that would I think reground it a little bit, but. There was, when I was growing up in the 80s in Britain, I mean, the film industry was kind of on its knees here. So that period that you were talking about here in the UK as well, unless you were making very well-spoken posh films, there didn't seem an awfully big way in. I just wanted to ask you about one name that keeps coming up. And I always mean to ask someone about it as soon as I can find the right person. And it's Byron Kennedy, who died so tragically young, but he and George Mellon, the zoetrope kind of thing they were trying to do, just seemed pivotal.
It was. Byron, I was hired because I knew how to load a Bolex camera. I was hired as a teacher at a film school run by the Australian Union of Students, a university group.
Yeah.
There we had 30 kids, young filmmakers, who had paid for or won scholarships to go to this one-month film course. I was one of three tutors, and I taught my 10 students how to load a camera, and then I gave them their first assignment, which was to film a meeting, a chase, a confrontation, and a resolution, all in one film. Now, back came the the other two groups, they were rubbish. Back came my group. I didn't do anything. But the director who elected himself as director was George Miller. And the cinematographer was a guy called Byron Kennedy. And what they brought back was a primer of film grammar. It was a perfect movie in 2 minutes and 45 seconds. Perfect movie. And that was where I met Byron, and that was where I met George. The last association I had with Byron was when I got married to Jan Chapman, and Byron shot the home movie of the wedding. Then Byron went, because I was now married and could no longer have a romance with Byron, so he went off with George, and they became partners and made Mad Max, which they financed themselves. Byron had one toy that he bought, which was his little helicopter. He took it out one Sunday after he lost his plane, as has happened many times. It happened here in California to friends of mine, or friends of friends, a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And he crashed, and he didn't die from the crash, but from the exposure of being there all night in the cold. He was with a young chap, a friend of his, and so who lived to tell the story. So that's Byron Kennedy. Byron was George's partner in every way, but after that, the accountant who worked for them, Doug Mitchell, has become the Byron Kennedy in George Miller's life. He's his producer. But Byron was a wonderful guy. He was an editor. He was a cinematographer. He was first and foremost a storyteller.
Yeah.
Like George.
Thank you for telling me that. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
I've got about 5 minutes left to get about 300 questions in. And so
I talk fast if you want.
No, that's good. I'll make them true or false. One of the, I'm just trying to find like kind of the little innovations that I don't think you're asked about an awful lot. And I found one again in the book on Dead Calm, on how you were pretty much ahead of the game on putting your shooting schedule into a computer and marrying that up to the weather conditions so that you could quickly adapt with the making of that film. I just wonder if you could tell me that a little bit.
Well, the reason is simple. It's called Dead Calm, and you're shooting out on the water that's not always calm and not always dead. So first thing we did was we said, okay, let's build a storm into the story, because we could see from the patterns during pre-production that, you know, every 10 days there was a storm out at sea. So we put a storm in. And then we realized after the first day that morning, noon, and afternoon produced completely different weather and watercolor conditions. So that's when we fed all the storyboards into a computer, because the whole film had been storyboarded, and realized that in the hour it took us to go from the island where we lived to where we were filming, we would phone up someone that was sleeping out there on a boat in that area where we were headed to film, and they would tell us what the prevailing winds and the rain and the watercolor and all of that was. And then we would schedule around that. It meant that at the end of 6 weeks, we had completed no scenes, but we completed parts of scenes throughout the movie, because we were just matching water conditions and weather conditions, you know, because the sea, unlike a set like behind me, look at it, it's not going anywhere. We can sit and talk here for hours, and it's always going to be the same, and I'll be just sitting here as well like a good actor. But out at sea, the background's going to keep changing all day as the sun changes, as the wind changes, but also the actor is going to float away, and you're putting your camera there, and suddenly it's got to be pointed over there, and that's what happens, you know. So that's why we fed it all into a computer, and the computer told us what to do, you know. We'd get radioed back with the weather conditions, and we'd put them in, and it would spit out, okay, scene 74, storyboards 9, 10, and 11. We'll start with them. Because they'll complete a scene that was shot in identical conditions.
And that was late 1980s computing as well. I mean, that's quite impressive.
It was actually 1988.
Yeah. I do want to just quickly, I wish I had a better question for this, but I'm one of many who watched Blind Fury well underage. You know what?
I don't think it was a computer. I think it was a brain. It was someone's brain, I think.
Is that right? I'm reading the book. I've got the little bit of the book here. I'm sure it was a brain. You were there, I wasn't. That there was a computer device.
It doesn't mean that my brain's working still perfectly. I might not be able to remember how we did it. But anyway, because I wasn't there whoever came back with the end, I'm not sure what they were working on.
No, I hear that. I respect that. Like many in the UK, I watched Blind Fury far too young and underage, as is the right way. But I just wonder, can you just give us a flavour of working? I know it's the most boring question to ask a filmmaker, but I don't hear many people talking about working with Rutger Hauer.
I'll tell you a story about Rutger Hauer.
Thank you.
We're right out in the middle of nowhere in Texas, and this convertible comes rolling onto the set, and this beautiful woman says, "Is Rutger Hauer here? I had to meet him at such and such a time." Anyway, that was one Rutger Hauer story. Another one was that Rutger he didn't want to stay in a hotel. He'd stay. He had a big bus. Like one of those buses that rock stars travel around in. Sort of like an RV van, but a luxury one. And so he would drive, would be driven out to set, and he'd sleep right there on the set. Maybe that's finally put those two stories together. The lady that was looking for Rutger. Rutger was a rogue.
I got that impression. And so, I mean, Fast Charlie, I think, came out in the States the back end of last year. It's coming out over here now. Where does that leave you? I mean, you held up a phone before. I mean, you're clearly intent on making lots more stories. Do you have the next couple of stories you want to tell in place?
The ones I want to tell, I've got. One is the story of Cowboy Bob, a famous bank robber in Texas in the 1990s, who robbed many banks, including in one day, three banks in a row. Now, if you go to your Google and Google Cowboy Bob, you'll see why, when you find out who was Cowboy Bob, you'll see why I want to make it into a movie. I'm not going to tell you the answer. I'm going to force you.
Okay, no. Sport. Okay.
Look up Cowboy Bob.
I will.
So that's the film that I'd love to make next. It all depends on getting the right actor and getting the right money.
I mean, are you close to something? Are you close to doing something again?
You know, you're always close, but an inch is the equivalent of, a million miles. You've got to have everything in place. And it usually starts with getting the right actor, and we're almost there with that as well. And when you get the right actor, the money comes as well. Usually it follows the actor. It doesn't follow the director. It follows the actor.
So I have to ask Philip Noyce, when are you coming to the UK so we can screen a lot of your films and hear these stories in person? Are you going to head our way soon?
Well, you're a man of great influence, so just tell the London Film Festival to have a retrospective. I was in Paris 2 years ago for a retrospective at the Cinémathèque Française. Boy, do they know how to love a director, those French.
What's your rider like? I mean, what level of luxury will you require? I can sort this.
Oh, not too much, I'm in a little hotel in Notting Hill is all I need.
So I've got people listening to this podcast now. So if we get you a room in a hotel for Notting Hill for a few days and a cinema showing your films, you'll come up and talk.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, all the films that I've made are stored at the National Film Archive in Canberra, Australia. So it's a one-stop shop if you're wanting to put it all together.
All right, you leave that. You leave that to me. My last question then is there a film you're never asked about that you just wish someone would ask you a question about?
Is there a film that people don't ask me a question about? Gosh, I don't get many questions about The Giver. The adaptation of Lois Lowry's dystopian novel.
Yes.
Not people ask about that film. I'm not sure why.
Well, I read an interview with you where you said you weren't particularly happy with elements of that.
Well, I wasn't happy with the job that I did. Put it that way. That was the first movie where I had a crisis of confidence.
Oh, okay.
It's a terrible thing that happens in a director's career, which is that all the tricks that you've carried with you, all the little pieces of magic that you're used to using, don't work. I remember in South Africa where we were filming, and the editor, wonderful editor, delivered the first cut of that movie, and I played it to myself over the Christmas break. And I'm looking at the film and I thought, oh my goodness, this movie just doesn't quite work. And it sent me into a terrible crisis because I thought I'd lost my knack. I'd lost my mojo, my little piece of magic that somehow pulled me out of every crisis before that. So maybe it's me that has sent out an unconscious message to interviewers not to ask about The Giver.
Yeah.
Because it only brings back that feeling of inadequacy that throughout, you know, a director's career, you're bound to strike.
Yeah.
You can't always be perfect.
So and is that what is that?
Some of us are a long way from it.
Oh, I'm nowhere near perfect. But appreciating you were doing a lot of television stuff as well, does that account for the gap then from The Giver to Above Suspicion? What was that, 6-7 years, I think it was? It's the longest filmmaking gap.
Movie-making gap. In between, I did pilots for TV.
Yes, that's what...
Can be all-consuming. Then I would do the pilot plus the first episode if the series got picked up.
So you got your mojo back quickly. Was it television that kind of refueled you a little bit?
It was actually, yeah. Yeah, I went on to a TV. I mean, I was catatonic. The only time I've been like that was when I looked at my first big feature, Newsfront, for the first cut. I looked at it and I went to bed for 2-3 days and just went into a complete depression.
Yeah.
And then I woke up from that depression after 3 days and decided the answer is music. I went into the city and I bought all these records of old newsreel and dramatic fanfares from the 50s. And I brought them back to the editing room and fed them into the movie. And we had a screening a week later and everyone said, it's a masterpiece. It's a masterpiece. Whereas I wanted to commit suicide or admit that I was going to be a teacher in some outback school, like out of that Australian movie, what's it called? It was made by Ted Kotcheff. Anyway, about an English teacher.
Can't remember it either, but I know what you mean.
Yeah, Wake in Fright.
Yeah.
Wake in Fright awaits me. I'll be a school teacher in an outback school. That'll be my career. But instead, I woke up and transformed the movie. Well, yeah. I did wake up eventually from my catatonic state on The Giver, but it was a TV project that woke me up.
I'm glad it woke you up on Newsfront. I'm glad it woke you up on the Gibber as well, because as mentioned right at the start, we got the best printer scene in the whole history of cinema, which I'm going to name check as many times. And when we get you to that Notting Hill Hotel, I'm going to put a special little laser printer in your hotel room ready for you, just as a tribute. Okay. Philip Noyce, thank you so much for joining us for this podcast special. A huge congratulations on Fast Charlie. I do hope we get you to the UK. This has been a real treat. Thank you.
Thank you. Speak to you later, I hope.
And as you can probably tell, I hope so too. Thank you for bearing a little bit with the audio of that one. I know it was a little bit testing, but hopefully you got the flavour of the conversation. Fast Charlie is available from Signature Entertainment now in the UK. It's really, really good as well. Really, really good. And as I say in the interview, like a 90-minute film that just gets to the point, gives Pierce Brosnan his best role in a long, 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 long time. Do you remember in The Matador? That was a great film as well, just as a little aside. It all brings me to the end of this latest episode of Film Stories, though. And so, I mean, I'm going to crack on starting to make the next one. You can find more from me in the interim at Simon Brew on Twitter and Blue Sky. You can find Film Stories there as well. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/filmstoriesonline, youtube.com/filmstories. Our store is store.filmstories.co.uk, which has our print magazines for sale. I'm a print magazine nerd, and we make big, thick print film magazines. Imagine that. Imagine putting your money into something like that, which is apparently dead. But here we are. We're still going. So any support there, much, much appreciated. Also, you can find our website at filmstories.co.uk. We update that every weekday with movie news, reviews, features, mayhem, stuff like that. We do a bit of TV, a bit of video games as well. We are trying to make a non-clickbait entertainment website. Again, imagine that. It will never catch on. All your support there is much appreciated. But that brings me to the very end. I will leave you in peace now. I've waffled on as usual far too much. Thank you for your support. Thank you for listening. I will be back soon with another bunch of film stories. Take care. Bye-bye.